Sports writer John Feinstein points out that one of the things that makes college basketball different from the pro game is that no player stays longer than 4 years. The names and faces always change, but Feinstein's interest in the game remains constant. His first book, A Season on the Brink, was a surprise bestseller about Bobby Knight, one of the most controversial coaches in college basketball. In Feinstein's new book, A Season Inside, he tries to explain the culture that surrounds the game. He crisscrossed the country, attending 104 college games during the 1987-88 season, interviewing players, coaches, and referees. Feinstein covered basketball and other sports for 11 years for the Washington Post and recently joined the staff of Sports Illustrated. Feinstein told me why he finds college basketball more interesting than professional basketball.
I think when you factor in atmosphere, intensity, games meaning something, the fact that college basketball is played during what I think should be the basketball season, which is the winter time. The pros play their most important games in the middle of the summer nowadays. I think when you factor all those things in, the college game is a better game. I can't think of anything better on a winter night than to be in a college gym where the place is rocking, the fans are really into it because every game is important because the colleges only play 30 games, and everybody is really intense about what's going on the court. In the pro game, most of the games you see, the places are half full, the gyms are quiet, and half the time the players don't really care what's going on until you get to the playoffs in April and May.
I have a friend who likes to say that if you want to see great players, watch the NBA games, but if you want to watch coaches suffer, watch college basketball.
Well, there's no question that coaches are the rock stars of college sports, basketball coaches. You can't really tell one football coach from another. They all look alike and they all sound alike, and they're all so far away when you're at a game anyway. You can't tell who's who. They're all dressed alike, too. But college basketball coaches are very distinct personalities, whether you're talking about Bob Knight or John Thompson or some of the guys who I followed closely in A Season Inside, like Rolly Massimino at Villanova, or Paul Evans at Pittsburgh, who the only thing they have in common is that they're both excellent coaches, but they're as different as two men can possibly be, and that may be part of the reason why there's a problem between the two of them. They don't get along at all. And then you have guys like Jim Valvano down at NC State who really want what his ambition in life really is to replace Johnny Carson.
Why have coaches become the stars of college basketball?
I think it has to do with a number of things. One is the intimacy. When you are at a college game, they are the guys you notice. They're the ones always jump. First of all, assistants can't get off the bench. So the only guy you ever see jumping off the bench is the head coach. And so you can't help but notice him. And if it's John Thompson, how can you miss a guy who's 6'10" and weighs 300 pounds? If it's Dean Smith, he's going to be the only guy in the building in French cuffs. If it's Rolly Massimino, he's going to be the only guy whose suit is falling apart during the game.
While we're talking about coaches, you, of course, wrote the best-selling book about Bobby Knight. And I was wondering if your book about him improved your access to other coaches and players when you were taking your tour of one basketball season, or whether it hurt you in any way.
Most of them reacted very positively because basketball people, when they read A Season on the Brink, even though Knight didn't like it, basketball people reading it felt that it was fair and that it was an accurate reflection of the way Knight is. So when I would approach a Gene Cady at Purdue or Lute Olson to ask if Steve Kerr could be involved in the project or Danny Manning and Larry Brown at Kansas, they all seemed to feel that since I had treated Knight fairly, that I would treat them fairly. And they were very open to giving me that kind of access that I had with Knight, getting into their locker rooms and their meetings and talking quite frankly to me about what was going on inside their teams during the season.
Well, Knight says that he didn't like your book and that one of the reasons why was that there was too much profanity in it, that you quoted you quoted all of his profanity. What were your reactions to his reaction to your book?
Well, one thing, and I don't think there'd be any dispute on this, I didn't quote all his profanity because if I had, the book would have been longer than War and Peace and War and Remembrance combined. But he somehow felt that I was going to leave all of his profanity out, and I had told him that for the book to be an accurate reflection of who he is, profanity had to be included because that's a part of his personality, a major part of it. But my reaction to his not liking the book was to write him and say, I'm sorry you don't like this because the access you gave me makes the book what it is. But I wouldn't change a word of it because I think it is what we set out to do, which was give people an idea of what it was like to live through a season with him.
It seems that the part of the season most universally hated by coaches is recruiting. You quote Jim Valvano as saying, if you're a decent human being on any level, you must hate what we do in recruiting.
Right. I think that if there's one thing all coaches agree on, it's that if they never had to recruit again, they would be very happy. Recruiting is something that is inherently dishonest. You are selling a product. You are telling kids that they are great, perfect, and wonderful, knowing full well that if they do come to your school, the minute they're enrolled as freshmen, you're going to start telling them they're terrible, they can't play, and if they don't listen to you, they're never going to get better. So there's a certain hypocrisy in that. I made home visits with a number of coaches, and I think the most honest coach I saw in action during a home visit was Dale Brown, who sat in a youngster's living room and said, you know, if I was really as good a person as I'm claiming to you that I am, I wouldn't be here tonight. I'd be out working for Mother Teresa. And he went on to say, I'm sitting here in New Jersey today telling you why it would be great for you to go to school in Louisiana, that your parents can get there by airplane very quickly, that it's no problem. Tomorrow I'm going to be in Baton Rouge and I'll be telling kids from Louisiana why they should stay home and be close to their families.
Now, the colleges are in a kind of funny situation. Do they admit that they're making lots of money from their star basketball players and treat them differently, therefore, from other students? Or do they try to treat the basketball stars as if they were just regular students and not acknowledge how much cash they're making from the teams?
Well, they admit that athletes are different by the very fact that they admit athletes to their school who would normally not get in. I mean, whether you're talking about Harvard mm-hmm. or Oklahoma State, the average board score or the average grade point average of the athletes, whether they be football or basketball players, those are the two revenue sports, are much lower than the average student. I mean, to get into a school let's take Duke, for example, which is the number one ranked basketball team in the nation right now. I said basketball. The average board score at Duke is somewhere in the 1200s. But basketball players can get in with board scores as low as 800. And Duke is one of the schools that has relatively high academic standards for athletes. And yet, they will admit basketball players who score over 400 points lower than the average because they're athletes.
You know, one of the coaches who you spoke to in the book described college basketball as a culture all its own, and I was wondering how close you think sports writers actually get into the culture.
I think it depends on the sports writer. I think the very best of them can do it, can make people explain that the good side of college basketball is more than just a game, to coin a phrase. But I think that when you see people like Steve Kerr, who come back from the assassination of his father when he was a freshman. His dad was assassinated by the PLO and rebound from that to become a folk hero in the whole state of Arizona. And you see even like the three seniors at Purdue who ended their careers very disappointingly because they'd had such a great season, but they were upset in the round of 16. But they walked away from it saying, you know, we had a lot of fights with Coach Katie over the years, but even though we lost, we figured out before it was over that what he was doing was right and that he had the experience and he knew what was best for us. Or you spend a night in the Palestra in Philadelphia, and the place just reeks of history. It's been there for 61 years now, and every team that ever mattered has played there. And you can feel that history when you're there. And the writers who really love the game and who understand the game and who I think most important understand the people in the game are the ones who add that extra dimension to their writing. And what I tried to do in this book was to give people an idea of what the people in the game are like, what a Don DeVoe at Tennessee is like fighting to save his job as opposed to a Rick Barnes, a first-year coach at George Mason, fighting to learn his job. And that's what I tried to do throughout the entire book.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
John Feinstein's new book, A Season Inside, is published by Villard Books. This is Fresh Air.